The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today we'll be reading from the Spring 2018 edition, Volume 57, Number 2 of the Tar Heel Junior Historian, Blackbeard, Secrets from Queen Anne's Revenge. The first article today is Underwater Archaeology by Kimberly Kenyon. Kimberly is a conservator at the Queen Anne's Revenge Conservation Lab. She's enjoyed diverse experiences both as an archaeologist and a conservator, working on material from shipwrecks ranging in date from 1200 BC to the 19th century. Kimberly is originally from Fairfield, Texas, and earned her MA in anthropology from Texas A&M University. She joined the Queen Anne Revenge's team in 2013. For as long as I can remember, I've been fascinated with archaeology and the mysteries of long-forgotten cultures that archaeologists work to unveil. My interest began with Egypt, and my mother often took me to our local library, where I soaked up every book on Egyptian history I could find. When I was in junior high, I remember watching a TV show about Alexandria, the Egyptian city, where the famous lighthouse, one of the seven ancient wonders of the world, once stood. Due to centuries of warfare and natural disasters, much of the ancient city had disappeared into the sea, and archaeologists at the time were just starting to explore the water for traces of Alexandria's ancient past. I remember watching divers carefully navigate through large building stones and fallen statues, and I was immediately drawn into this exciting world of underwater exploration. That was the moment that shaped my decision to pursue a career in underwater archaeology. Archaeology is not limited to just one time or place. Whenever and wherever humans roamed holds a world of possibility to learn about our past. Underwater archaeologists, sometimes called nautical, marine, or maritime archaeologists, study a specific part of human existence. How people have interacted with oceans, seas, rivers, and lakes. Sometimes underwater archaeology is mistakenly equated with the hunt for sunken treasure. The reality is that in the past, the waterways were treated as a vast network of highways, and ships were the easiest and safest ways to move people or goods over great distances. Think of an ancient cargo ship as the 18-wheeler of its time. Do you think many large trucks on the highway today are carrying valuable gold and silver? Probably not. Trucks are responsible for carrying food from where it is grown to grocery stores, or moving large pieces of equipment from where they are manufactured to where they will be used. In the millennia leading up to the 20th century, the world was not as well connected over land, and so ships were used for the same purpose. Many underwater archaeologists are interested in how ships were built and how that construction changed through time to better suit the needs of the people using them. While shipwrecks do play a key role in the interpretation of our seafaring history, they're not the only form of evidence we study. Some underwater archaeologists research ports and harbors to understand the importance of the waterways to the local population. Some may study what role ships have played in warfare through the ages. Others examine the cargoes of shipwrecks to learn about ancient trade networks. More recently, underwater archaeologists are helping to search for and document sunken aircraft. Still others delve into sunken cities like Alexandria. There are many ways to explore the impact of water on our lives. To become an underwater archaeologist, it takes several years of education and training beyond 4 years of college. Universities in the United States offer undergraduate courses in underwater archaeology, but there are currently no colleges where you can earn a bachelor's degree in it. A handful of universities, including East Carolina University, Texas A&M University, and the University of West Florida, offer graduate-level education in the specialized area of archaeology. Most of us working in the field today have a master's degree or a PhD or both, and have completed months, if not years, as volunteers and interns building our skills before finding a full-time job. First, we study the core principles of all archaeology, such as how to establish a date for a site, how to map and document a site, and how to carefully handle fragile artifacts. But an underwater archaeologist must also be trained in scientific diving. Archaeological diving is usually riskier than recreational diving. Divers must be confident and able to handle difficult conditions like zero visibility, heavy currents, extreme depths, extreme temperatures, and hazardous marine life, all while investigating what can sometimes be very delicate artifacts. The job market is growing and includes an array of opportunities. Governments hire underwater archaeologists to protect shipwrecks within state and federal boundaries. Universities hire underwater archaeologists to conduct research and teach students. Private companies with offshore interests even hire underwater archaeologists to help search for shipwrecks that might be impacted by oil and gas lines. The possibilities are endless, and new opportunities arise every day. As the job market expands, so does the technology available to archaeologists. At one time, our toolkit was fairly simple: a dredge to remove sand, a pencil, a tape measure, and a slate to record measurements. Now, advances in the way we image sites has drastically improved the speed at which they can be recorded. Shipwrecks that were once so deep that they were considered out of reach can now be accessed by remotely controlled vehicles, ROVs. Sonar, which is a method or device of locating objects using sound waves sent out to be reflected by the objects, can even tell us what lies beneath the sand. So there is no need to disturb an archaeological site if it's buried and protected. Photography has also become much more sophisticated. A diver can take a series of photographs and use software to stitch the images together, rendering the site in 3D on a computer. Much like other aspects of our lives, technology has greatly impacted archaeology. Underwater archaeology in North Carolina began in 1962 with the recovery of Civil War blockade runner Modern Greece. Historic ships in our waters include early sailing vessels, dugout canoes, a famous pirate ship, Civil War ironclads, and ships lost during World War II. Thousands of sites have been documented in North Carolina waters alone, and is the very reason the Outer Banks is called the Graveyard of the Atlantic. But these sites are not just shipwrecks, but also ports, lighthouses, ferry landings, and bridges. This vast nautical heritage makes North Carolina one of the most culturally rich states in the nation. One of the most significant shipwrecks in North Carolina waters is Blackbeard's flagship Queen Anne's Revenge. In November 1996, Intersal Incorporated discovered the shipwreck using information provided to Operations Director Mike Daniel by Company President Phil Masters. Underwater archaeologists for the state of North Carolina have been fully excavating the site since 2005, and about half the shipwreck has been explored. Since the ship was associated with such a famous historical figure, and very little physical evidence of piracy survives, it was decided to fully excavate the wreck site. All artifacts will eventually be removed from the seabed so that the collection can be thoroughly researched and we can gain a better understanding of life aboard a pirate ship. Once artifacts are fully documented and stabilized, they are displayed at the North Carolina Maritime Museum in Beaufort, only a short distance from where Queen Anne's Revenge ran aground 300 years ago. Being able to tell the story of a lost part of history is the most important goal in underwater archaeology, because that allows everyone to appreciate and learn about our shared heritage. Here are the captions accompanying some of the photographs that are part of this article. concreted dead-eye straps at the Queen Anne's Revenge shipwreck site create beautiful underwater sculpture. Imagine the thrill of swimming up to this site, one of Blackbeard's anchors half buried in the seafloor. The crew watches, anxious but excited, as another of Blackbeard's anchors is slowly hauled up from the water in May 2011. Archaeologist and conservator Kim Kenyon suited up for historical research underwater. At a Saturday Queen Anne's Revenge Lab tour event, visitors get the chance to view many of the recovered artifacts, including one of Blackbeard's anchors, now resting in a holding tank. There's also a sidebar article, Think About It. What is history? It's the study of what has happened in the past, even what you did 5 minutes ago. What is a historian? It's a person who loves and studies history, like you. Some historians study history and museum studies and find careers at places like the North Carolina Museum of History. Others, like the people in this issue who are studying Queen Anne's Revenge, work in the water or in archaeology labs. Historians can be curators and conservators, divers and underwater archaeologists, photographers and illustrators, journalists and writers. Can you think of other ways people can do historical research? How do you study history? The next article is, How Do You Save a Sunken Ship? Conserving Blackbeard's Queen Anne's Revenge. It's written by Ariana DiMucci, who is a conservator at the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab. She earned her MA in anthropology from Texas A&M University. She's helped excavate Roman-era shipwrecks in Sri Lanka and Croatia, and has conserved artifacts from terrestrial and maritime sites alike. Imagine standing on Blackbeard's ship, a vessel roughly 100 feet long by 30 feet wide, with masts stretching overhead and all the equipment you might expect to find on board a pirate ship, from cannon and lead shot to pewter plates and gold dust. Now pictured Queen Anne's Revenge almost 300 years later, buried in sand, cannons stuck together in a pile, the ship's stern post, all that remains of the once large wooden vessel, with thousands of small artifacts just waiting to be unearthed. So what is conservation, which is the careful preservation and protecting of something, such as historical artifacts, have to do with archaeology, particularly underwater archaeology? The answer might surprise you. Conservation as a profession deals with the intricacies of preserving our history. There are almost as many kinds of conservators as there are materials to work with. There are book and paper conservators, textile conservators, painting conservators, sculpture conservators, and objects and archaeological conservators. The artifacts from Queen Anne's Revenge are our primary resources for understanding and interpreting the shipwreck, which makes them really important. Much as doctors vow to do no harm to their patients, conservators follow a code of ethics to preserve the delicate artifacts in our care, stabilizing and treating finds to stop deterioration and protect them for the future. Artifacts, whether removed from a site on land or recovered underwater, have typically experienced a rough life prior to their recovery. On land, moisture, oxygen, hot and cold cycles, the activity of microorganisms, and variable soil conditions such as pH, salinity, and groundwater penetration all affect what survives and in what condition an artifact is in when excavated. Underwater, iron artifacts attract marine growth and sand that, coupled with the effects of the metal corroding, result in the formation of what we call concretions, a concrete-like material that covers the surface of the iron object. Other nearby objects from other metals, such as lead and copper, to the often surprising survival of organic materials, such as wood, hair, or rope, can also get trapped in this concrete-like matrix. That means that a lot of the time we can't see what an artifact is at first. The surrounding concretion makes it look like a shapeless blob. Layers of concretion and the presence of harmful salts. It's clear that waterlogged materials require a lot of special care after excavation. Don't worry, you probably would too if you were 300 years old. Many of the finds from Blackbeard's ship are rediscovered in our lab before being seen anywhere else. Even the tiniest artifacts, glass bead fragments, copper pins, and grains of gold dust are recovered here. The archaeology doesn't stop with the divers on site. It continues in the lab as we individually excavate each concretion, working carefully to ensure the long-term preservation of these materials. Becoming a conservator requires an advanced graduate degree, such as a master's degree or even a PhD. While specialized programs for archaeological conservation exist, in many cases, conservators have earned their degrees in related fields such as archaeology or anthropology and have certificate in conservation. Such graduate-level programs provide foundational coursework, while internships and work experience offer the hands-on training necessary for working with archaeological objects. Conservators may work in a variety of settings, from a lab like the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab to on-site archaeological or historical sites. Conservators may also work for museums or other cultural institutions, or they might teach, providing expert care for artifacts while training others, educating the public, and working alongside other professionals to curate, manage, exhibit, and display history. There are a couple of photographs. Captioned on the first is a close-up of Arianna DiMucci working on a concretion. And the second is Karen Martindale and Arianna DiMucci using air scribes, think of them as mini jackhammers, to carefully work on removing precious artifacts from a concretion. What follows in this article are six more articles, each describing a step of the conservation process. The first one, step one, is called X-radiation. The article is by Terry Williams, who served 20 years with the United States Air Force and upon retirement attended the conservation program at City and Guilds of London Art School. After working in various conservation jobs in London, Virginia, and Boston, she returned to North Carolina and began working with the Queen Anne's Revenge team as an assistant conservator. Have you or a friend ever broken an arm? Have you ever gone to the hospital to get an X-ray? It may surprise you to know that the staff at the Queen Anne's Revenge Conservation Lab also uses X-rays, though in a different way. The Queen Anne's Revenge has been hidden off the coast of North Carolina for almost 300 years. Those years have not been kind, slowly eroding away the organic components and encasing the metals of the ship in concretion, which is a hard, solid mass of mineral matter that forms around an artifact over time. This layer of concrete or ugly coral material must be removed before treatment of the objects within can continue. To start our work, we use X-radiation to look inside the concretions and identify the artifacts they contain. In the X-ray process, electromagnetic radiation, or light, is projected toward the object. Some light is absorbed by the object, depending on its density and makeup. The rest is captured below the object and results in exposing the film. At the lab, we manipulate time, energy, power, and the focal point of the transmitting source. Unfortunately, our X-rays only show reliably metals, so wood, glass, and textiles will not normally show up in X-ray. Look at the photos and objects hidden beneath the concreted surface. If you compare the X-ray to the picture of the concretion, you might have been able to identify the cannonball identified here as shot, but the rest is pure mystery. Of note, the cannonballs and grenades are made from the same type of material, but the grenades are hollow to allow for gunpowder, giving them this donut appearance. You sure can tell that this is a pirate ship from this concretion, can't you? Since there were so many concretions, conservators look at these x-rays when determining which project to work on next. For example, one conservator is gathering watch components. Another is researching gun carriage assemblies. In short, x-rays are illuminating. Here's the caption to the photograph that was referred to in this article. This x-ray was taken of a concretion before conservation work began. What can you learn from comparing the images? Why did only some of the objects show up? On the photograph are identified lead shot, two grenades, some dividers, some calipers, and cannon shot. Next article is Step 2, Concretion, also written by Terry Williams. Most of the artifacts of the Queen Anne's Revenge are surrounded by concretion. Picture that as ugly coral. Concretions can be small enough to fit in your hand or large enough to cover a cannon or an anchor. The lab in Greenville has literally thousands of concretions from the Queen Anne's Revenge shipwreck site. Conservators begin the process of removing concretion by visually assessing the concretion and its matching x-ray and then determining how to proceed. If mechanical means are chosen, which is probably 99.9% of the time, the next step is to assemble all required materials. This includes dust collectors, air hoses, and safety gear. Pretty comprehensive equipment, right? Among other things, this gear protects our eyes from flying debris, our ears from noise, our lungs from dust, and beat-up blue jeans from the inevitable muck. Once geared up, the conservator will often use an air scribe. Think of it as a small jackhammer. The air scribe uses a hard bit or a nib and compressed air to remove concretion with precision accuracy. On occasion, larger, more percussive methods can be used, but are largely avoided. The cleaning process can take anywhere from a few hours to a few years, depending on the size, complexity, and fragility of the concreted artifacts. Concretions that contain a single solid iron artifact are going to take much less time to clean as compared to a concretion like the one pictured in this article, which has a multitude of artifact types made up of different materials. The conservator must use a light, careful hand to remove the dense concretion without damaging the artifact underneath, which could be anything from a cannonball and grenade to copper calipers and ceramics. Here are the captions for that article. Conservator Stephen Atkinson dons protective gear to do the fascinating but messy work of removing concretion from an artifact. These photos show the progression of the concretion breakdown. First, the initial mysterious blob of concretion. Two, after some of the concretion has been removed. Three, gradually the artifacts begin to appear. And four, just one of the artifacts, a set of calipers, that can now be cleaned, studied, and displayed. Step 3, Desalination, by Elise B. Carroll, who is an assistant conservator at the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab. From Greenville, she began volunteering at the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab during her undergraduate studies. Completing her undergraduate degree at the University of Mississippi in History and Anthropology, Elise returned home to attend East Carolina University's program in Maritime Studies. Have you ever been to the beach and at the end of the day, salt and sand cover everything? Unsurprisingly, after 300 years in the ocean, Queen Anne's Revenge artifacts are also salty. The salt from seawater enters most of the artifact through osmosis, which is a process, a concreted solution, seawater going through a membrane, the surface of the artifact, to a less concentrated solution inside of the artifact to balance the amount of salt on both sides. Even if the artifact's surface appears to be clean, most must remain wet because the artifacts are still very salty. If artifacts dry with salt inside, crystals can grow and place pressure on the artifact, potentially ruining it. Crystallization can continue to occur after the artifact is dry because of the humidity in the air, particularly in northeastern North Carolina. Materials such as a glass, wood, or a ceramic go through a specific type of desalination, the process of removing salt. We desalinate artifacts by placing them into progressively less salty water. Through osmosis, the salt in the artifact slowly leaves the object and goes into the surrounding water until the two equalize. We start desalination in tap water because it is much less salty than seawater. Each week, the water is tested to see if the amount of salt in the water increased or is similar to the previous week's readings. When the reading plateaus, the water is changed and we begin the testing process again. After the reading is close to that of tap water, the artifacts are placed in reverse osmosis purified, RO, or filtered water. RO water is regularly found as a type of bottled water in stores. When the artifact's water reads zero salt, it has completed desalination, is safe from salts, and will begin the next part of conservation. But before that, here are the captions from the two photographs with this article. A plastic bin, some rubber gloves, and a TDS, total dissolved salt meter. Tools that ECU student Kelsey Schmitz uses to measure salt in the water. This cast iron cannonball was not desalinated. Runaway corrosion and physical stresses have caused it to break apart, making it almost unrecognizable. Here's a related activity just for fun. Cookie concretions. Think it's easy to clean up 300-year-old pirate artifacts dragged from the bottom of the ocean? Then try this. Get some cookies with M&Ms and some tweezers, a paintbrush, straw, etc. First, lay the cookie flat on a plate or paper towel. Slowly, slowly use your tools to gently extract, which is remove, an M&M, the artifact, from the concretion, which is the cookie part. Be careful not to break it. It's harder than you think. Last step, eat the broken cookie, but eat your dinner first. We will resume next time the article on underwater conservation, how do you save a sunken ship. And just a preview, step four will be bulking and consolidation, step five, documentation, and step six, dry storage and museum transfer. We've run out of time for today's episode of Independent Living. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. If you have any comments, concerns, or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long until next time.